Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this podcast here from Chicago, Illinois, on this cooler, rainy weekday. In this podcast, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Dr. Brett Valkenhorst. He is the Chief Technology Officer of Bastille. Brett, thanks for joining us, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Yeah, thanks, Robbie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we looked up your bio, did some background snooping on you, and I mean, nothing like a background check or anything, but can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and kind of like how you got started to where you're at and where you're at today and where you hope to go in the future?
Yeah, sure. So I started my career getting a bachelor's and a master's degree in electrical engineering, and I went to work as an RF engineer, or radio frequency designing base stations. I went back to school to get a PhD in MIMO communications in electrical engineering.
Wow. Okay.
And so, yeah, I've done a lot of work in signal processing, electromagnetics, RF, antennas, just a lot of a pretty broad range of different topics. And then spent some time at Georgia Tech doing research in things like multi-antenna architectures, interference mitigation, signal localization. And then I ended up working at different companies doing things like antenna pattern measurements, signal detection, electronic warfare, radar. And then most recently, a couple years back, joined Bastille to dive into cybersecurity applications for wireless. So that's kind of where I live.
Okay, excellent.
I love learning new things all the time, and I think I love like discovering new ideas. So, I mean, you asked about career highlights. One of the things that I really enjoyed, I joined a company a few years back to dive into a new topic of radar signal processing, which is something that I hadn't really touched up until that point, and just dove in and developed some new technologies that were patentable, but ultimately decided to protect as trade secrets. And that was just super satisfying to be able to dive in and, you know, within like 6 to 9 months, develop these new capabilities. So I love that kind of thing. And so here, you know, with a chance to kind of dive into a new domain of cybersecurity has also been really interesting and just fun to learn new stuff.
Excellent. Sounds wonderful. Now, is Bastille a company that you helped start, or you just kind of joined in when after it was started?
Yeah, I joined in later. So I was aware when they started because a friend of mine was part of their founding team, but I kind of lost track of them until a couple years back. And then actually the same friend of mine that we'd worked together at Georgia Tech, he pinged me and said, hey, I think maybe you should come join us.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Now, let me see here. How long has Bastille been in business? And one thing I want to ask is, how did you get the name Bastille, and what does it mean exactly?
I don't have a good answer to the last question. I'm not entirely sure where the name came from. I wasn't part of that founding team. But to me, Bastille always was associated with the French prison, which is infamous because of its connection to the French Revolution. I don't know if that's the right thing to think about. You could also think about the rock band. Maybe that's more fun. But, you know, it's the name. So we're about security, wireless security specifically. Bastille has been in business since 2014. It started out focused on IoT security, and then it became apparent pretty quickly that that wasn't going to be sufficiently broad to establish a good product market fit. And so kind of expanded the focus and initially took on the task of detecting and localizing individual cellular devices. And that was really what kicked us off in terms of our ability to hit the market and grow. So now we're all things wireless security. That's the latest.
That's definitely a hot button topic today for sure. Now, do you have presence in other countries, or are you just local to the Bay Area market?
Well, definitely not Bay Area market. We're definitely pretty heavy throughout the U.S. We do have some presence in some other countries, but our focus is still primarily on the U.S. given where we're at in our growth trajectory, I think that, that probably makes sense for the foreseeable future. But, yeah.
Now, can you tell us more about your product line and what you've developed, and if you can do a deep dive into some of these topics, please?
Absolutely. So our product, so I mentioned we're all about wireless security, right? Our product starts with RF sensors, and these are basically like a large dinner plate in size, maybe 3 or 4 inches high. So kind of like a large access point. And these are very, very capable multi-channel broadband RF systems. And they're software-defined radio-based, so they have flexibility to adapt their behavior over time. But basically, we use these to sniff the spectrum. They work together as a team to go and synchronously look at different parts of the spectrum and detect, demodulate, and decode packet header information from signals that they see. And they're doing this, like, in parallel. So lots of demodulations going on at the same time. It's a very beefy, very powerful kind of system, and it's sucking in a lot of information and then passing that data back to a server where localization is done. So basically what we're getting is temporal, spatial, and behavioral information of the wireless signals by means of detecting the packets, localizing those emissions, and extracting metadata from the packet headers that we detect. And all that data goes into a database, and then you can visualize the results in any number of ways. But one nice way to think about it is if you can look at a floor plan map in a UI, you can see maybe dots or icons that overlay that floor plan that indicate the presence of wireless devices and their locations within the facility. And then you can dig into those individually to extract metadata, or you can take a totally different view and just look at it from a high-level point of view, you know, looking at analytics from different dimensions, different aspects of the data that's available to make sense out of what's happening. And, you know, so part of this is on the back end. There's analytics tools that try to automate the process of transforming this data into actionable insights for you so that, you know, you can see when something is behaving strangely and then, you know, make some assessment of what's happening and possibly take action if necessary. So that's kind of the bulk of the process. And we offer two flavors of this product with basically the same hardware, software, firmware, maybe a little bit of a nuance in the hardware occasionally, but the vast majority of this is all the same. And one flavor would be for permanent installations in a facility where you can get persistent data over time that allows you to build an understanding of the RF behavior so you can get baselines and look for deviation. And then another flavor would be you give up that persistence for the flexibility to relocate some number of sensors for things like temporary deployments, audits, events, things like that. So those are the two basic flavors. But, yeah, we work with a lot of different customers in a lot of different locations to provide that kind of insight into their wireless environment.
Yeah, excellent. Now, who's your typical customer base, and what's your sweet spot, the SMBs, Fortune 500, federal government, state governments, or is it a combination of all three of them?
I think that where we've had the most success so far has been primarily very large companies, very large commercial companies. These are primarily focused on things like secure computing facilities, data centers, executive protection, technical surveillance countermeasures, and use cases along those lines. And then we also have a large presence within federal government customers. We've got systems deployed throughout the Department of Defense, intelligence community, Department of Energy, and others, because they're typically more sensitive about wireless devices in general, because for decades they've been they've been exposed to threats on the lines of bugs planted where they shouldn't be, listening to sensitive discussions. So I think they've been much more skittish for many years than most commercial entities, and they have very strict policies about devices. So for them, they have the ability now to independently look at what's happening in the wireless domain and have a mechanism for enforcing policies that up until now are largely based on the honor system. So that's been interesting because we've seen, I've worked with some government customers over the years, and it's been amazing to me since I joined Bastille just how much is actually happening that probably shouldn't be happening. So we're helping to lock that down, which is really satisfying.
Cool, excellent. Do you have any customer success stories or client testimonials you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe, so I kind of hinted at this just a second ago, but one of the most interesting things is that we go and deploy in a new location, and we almost always, maybe always, but I'll say almost always so that I'm sure I'm accurate, we almost always see something we shouldn't see. And that always opens people's eyes to, hey, there's stuff going on here that I didn't realize was going on. And a very common case would be for a government facility where they think nothing's happening, and we see, you know, maybe a dozen or 20 things pop up, and we're like, okay, let's go figure out what that is, and let's go find that. So we see things right away. But what's been fascinating to me, and this is like your customer success story, is that on a regular basis, we are finding these things, like on a daily basis, literally in a customer facility where we've been deployed for years. We get, you know, daily occurrences, maybe one or maybe half a dozen violations that they go and take care of. So that I think is huge success because, again, previously these customers didn't have the ability to adjudicate. They didn't have the ability to enforce, and now they do. Some other examples would be things like we go deploy, or either we do a short-term assessment, or if it's permanent deployment, and right away we see something like in a data center. Once we found a laptop that was connected to one of the data center servers, and that laptop, first of all, it should never have been connected, but it was sending out Wi-Fi and Bluetooth packets, which leaves a big security hole in their infrastructure. So we've got this wireless hole that's just blasting out. And by the way, these wireless signals don't care if there's walls around. They sail right through. So things that are outside the data center could connect to those, to a device inside and exploit that wireless connection to then tunnel right into the server. So that's a huge hole that shouldn't be there. So they were able to detect that and get rid of it. Another example in a data center where they had these industrial chillers that were connected behind the firewall. So they had some network access, don't know how much, but they had some. And yet at the same time, the facilities people had no idea this was occurring until we deployed, but they had a wireless mode enabled by whoever had installed them that was blasting out Zigbee, which was unencrypted. Now Zigbee is a wireless IoT protocol. And so basically they had these chillers that were dual homed, but one of the mechanisms was a wireless interface that had no encryption on it. So anybody from outside the facility would be able to connect to that and, again, get right into their network. Now, this was actually done intentionally by the contractor who had installed because they were also on contract to maintain. And they would leverage that Zigbee interface to maintain the product from the parking lot so they didn't have to go through the physical security stuff to get into the facility, which, again, points to the fact that this was very vulnerable to attack from outside. We also saw in one of our customers' facilities, we found a device that's called a USB Ninja cable. We found it on an executive floor of this company. And this is a cable that looks just like an innocuous USB cable. There's no way to tell the difference. But inside the sleeve or the jacket of one of the ends of the cable is a microcontroller and it's implementing, in this case, a Bluetooth wireless stack, and it allows an attacker to connect wirelessly to this cable and do things like keystroke injection and data exfiltration wirelessly. So we found one of those on an executive floor and were able to identify it and remove it. In a lot of the cases, the things we find, we just find behavior that includes risk or that indicates risk and potentially just a misconfiguration. But that misconfiguration of a wireless device could be problematic if it were to be exploited. And so a lot of what we do is just identify strange behavior that allows customers to kind of shore up their security posture and prevent incidents from happening. But by having this kind of visibility into your wireless domain, you can identify incidents as they occur in real time. So that's a huge benefit to try to prevent things from escalating and getting worse.
Wow, excellent. Wow.
Now, it seems like, you know, that Bastille is on the cutting edge of a lot of different things that's going to, with issues, you know, like with mobile security, that's going to be prevalent down the road for a long time. What are the company's plans for expansion, you know, without giving out too much confidential information?
Well, to be honest with you, we're growing fast, just given the capabilities that I've described to you. So most of our focus is on maintaining that momentum and reaching the customers who have this need and growing along with the need as awareness grows. But we're trying to focus our development efforts on continually improving the quality of the product. And some of the ways that I think we're most focused on are continually improving our analytics capabilities. So the back end, we gather all this data, and we've done a really good job like making sense out of the mess. And we put all this data into a database. Now we have this crap ton of data that someone's got to look at. So we've been developing tools that have made our customers' lives easier, but I think there's still a lot of gain to be had by continuing to improve the sophistication of those tools. So we're continuing to improve that and roll out, updated capabilities to customers on a regular basis. And the other thing that we're really focused on developing, I mean, you say expansion, but really for expansion, we're just focused on like penetrating the market that already exists. For expanding our capabilities, it's about improving our analytics tools and continuing to expand our portfolio of integrations with third-party tools. We have a number of these that have been built, but we continue to expand as we get requests from customers for specific things because we need to be able to like integrate with SIM and SOAR and MDMs and you know incident response tools and all that stuff that makes up an ecosystem. You know, we have to be able to connect with all those things. So we have this mechanism that's worked out really, really well. It's very flexible, but we can continue to expand those capabilities as new products are of interest to customers. So I think those two thrusts are the primary focus right now.
Wow. Yeah. Now, how do you, in terms of reaching out to customer sales, do you do direct sales or do you use like a partner VAR approach or what works for you?
Well, I'm the CTO, which is technology, but I do know enough about sales to maybe answer this question at a high level. We do talk with customers directly and we're happy to work with them directly if that's the right mechanism. But we have a number of customers who for various reasons like contracting purposes and others require some kind of a sales channel. And we have a network of folks that we've worked with and we continue to expand as necessary. So I think we do both. We just try to do what makes sense for the customer.
Okay, excellent. Now, just to kind of segue the show into some of the cyber issues here, which are happening this year. We keep hearing about nation-state threat actors. You know, I'm not going to get into politics or anything, but, you know, like when Russia invade Ukraine, now this thing with Israel and Hamas, there's just every time something geopolitical happens, now there's always something coming up. And, like, even during COVID, that was, like, the worst of it with ransomware and, you know, phishing and malicious websites, fake websites. What are your thoughts on all that?
No, my thoughts are this is all very sad. Wow, that's a very good question. Let me focus on the first part. You talked about nation states, right? This is unfortunately a threat that's not going away. I think it's been many years building. Quite frankly, some of the nations that you're most concerned about have been investing in this for as long and maybe even longer than some of the Western nations have been investing. They saw very early on the potential here. And I think everybody sort of recognizes that cyber is a battle domain. So in conflict, cyber is going to be one of the toolkits that gets pulled out to achieve tactical and strategic objectives in conflict. And that's sobering and maybe a little scary, but it is the reality. And unfortunately, it's the world we're living in right now. So I guess, you know, interesting, I listened to this fascinating podcast series at the recommendation of our CEO just recently on North Korea's Lazarus Group. And I learned so much about, you know, that group and what motivates them. But you know, one of the things that I learned that was surprising to me was that, and in hindsight, it's not surprising, but at the moment I was like, oh, wow, yeah, that's cool, is that the group offers North Korea a significant source of revenue through its cyber activities. So some of that might be ransomware, but more commonly it's things like bank heists or cryptocurrency theft. And as long as that kind of a regime can be supported by a group that engages in cyber activities like that, that's going to continue, right? And then other nation states view it from a more strategic perspective and less from a financial point of view. But if they believe that they can get some kind of an advantage in a conflict by engaging in cyber warfare, that's exactly what they're going to do, right? So this trend, unfortunately, is probably going to continue to grow, and it's not a happy one. And then, of course, there's the other side, like crime and terrorism that are going to leverage those tools as well. And cyber criminals, ransomware is just huge. It boggles my mind. And I wish that would go away too. But unfortunately, right, it seems like that's just continuing to grow. So, yeah, it's kind of the world we live in right now.
Wow, okay. Well, another topic I kind of want to bring to your attention is AI, you know, machine learning, AI. You know, excuse me, it's been around for a long time, probably since, what, the 1950s. But it really hasn't picked up by the attention of the American public until ChatGPT came out. Now everything, every buzzword you hear is AI, ML. Cyber vendors, they're pushing products with AI and ML, and I have a lot of issues with that. To me, AI is nothing but garbage in, garbage out. I mean, I've written two books on it already, and my dad was a professor of neurobiology at Purdue, actually, in spinal cord regeneration research, and you know, we had discussions about the brain, about understanding it, replicating it, and you know, we'll never come close to understanding what the human brain is, not even up to 1%. What are your thoughts on AI? Does Bastille make use of it? And are you getting kind of tired of all this hype and blabber about AI and ML all over the place?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of that question? I missed it.
Are you tired of hearing about AI and ML being kind of like blabber and, you know, being thrown around all over the place like a, you know, like another verb or, you know, noun or what, we know what have you, so.
Yeah, well, let me take the last part of that question first because it's kind of funny. I guess in a way I do get kind of tired of the hype, but I'm an engineering mind, and I think I get a little weary of the hype almost no matter what. So, you know, a few years back there was a ton of hype about 5G cellular technologies coming out, and I was trying to stay aware of what was happening in that space. You know, we'd go to conferences to try to, you know, see what people were talking about, and I was part, for a little while, I was part of the 3GPP committee that was, you know, developing the standards for 5G. And it was amazing to me how much hype there was and how much what I consider to be nonsense being spouted. So yeah, I do get a little tired of that sometimes. But I think in a way it's really good that we have the hype, because it gets enough attention on something that, like you say, has been decades in the making, and it has had hype come and go. It has had a huge amount of hype with disappointed expectations because AI didn't develop in the way that people thought it should, maybe in the 60s and 70s. And then there was some hype maybe in the 90s, and then it's come back again, but now we're seeing enough application that it's really quite exciting. But I've been following this for some time. I remember taking a class where I was learning about neural networks, and I've implemented some myself, and it's really pretty cool stuff. But these, like you say, these neural networks are a crude attempt to approximate neurons and neural connections in the human brain, and they really are truly crude approximations. But by implementing, you know, this network of nodes in a way that introduces some nonlinearities to get some, you know, kind of strange behaviors, you can do some really cool things. The challenge is that once we get enough hype, we start kind of going off the rails and trying to apply this to everything. But I think in this case, it might actually be pretty useful in some ways, and yet we're going to overblow it because of the hype. So these large language models that have been coming out are really pretty astounding in their capabilities. The danger is that we start to take them as truth. If we use them as tools and not a source of truth, I think we're probably in pretty good shape, but we just need to be cautious about how we use them and how much we trust what they're producing. That would be my biggest concern. You asked about whether we use AI, and the answer is that we do. We have some AI capabilities that enable us to do accurate localization in certain cases for wireless protocols. And as I mentioned, so we're doing detection and localization, so you can identify where something is. We have some AI that allows us to do that localization a little bit more accurately, but it's not all AI. We also have some AI that we used for our research to develop heuristics that allow us to do things a little more effectively in terms of detection of specific types of threats. And we're continuing, as I mentioned, to improve our analytics capabilities. And for that, I think this is an excellent application of AI, by the way. We are beginning to use AI more as we're developing some of these detection and alerting capabilities, with the idea that this gives us an indication of something that might be off that should be adjudicated by a human operator to determine whether there's something really concerning going on. But it allows you to sift through a significant amount of data and identify something with some probability. It's not 100% accurate, but you can identify that, hey, this looks to be like something you might be concerned about. Here's what I know about it. And then a human can make a decision about, you know, whether it's an issue and what they want to do. So that was a lot to answer your question. Hopefully I hit all the points there.
Oh, you did. My next hot button issue or topic is the Internet of Things. I mean, you know, that's where things all connected. I find that to be a very scary proposition. I don't have a smart home or smart car. I mean, I have like an old Honda Civic 03, all analog instrumentation. I'm actually quite happy with that. I've got a couple of friends who have these smart cars. They clap their hand and the car comes out. But, you know, hearing the punishing Chicago winters, if one electronic sensor goes out, your whole car has to be, you know, looked at. What are your thoughts on the IoT?
Sure.
Home or smart car or anything like that?
Or did you ask if I have smart home, car?
Yeah. I mean, do you have like a smart home or like, what are your thoughts on IoT?
Okay, well, I'll give you the personal side, and then I'll give you some general thoughts. I'm kind of like you. I drive my cars into the ground, so I don't need the latest and greatest bells and whistles, which is, you know, just a personality quirk, but it's who I am. And then other people have quirks that take them the other direction, and that's fine too. We do implement a few things to automate some things in the home, and I'm not going to give you specifics just so no one tries to go out and, like, hack my IoT, but you know, we don't really go full bore on that either. Just a few things that, you know, whether it's lights or whatever. In fact, well, I'll tell you one of them. We do at Christmas time, we use like a smart plug that I can put on a schedule so that it'll turn the lights on at a certain time and turn them off at a certain time. So that's kind of nice. Then I don't have to go outside and, you know, plug things in and unplug them. As far as IoT and where it's headed, I don't want to be too much of a prophet here. I just want to point out things that I know statistically, things like there's a huge amount of IoT out there. Smart homes, smart cities are one way to look at this. Smart factories or monitoring of infrastructure, those I think – to me, make a bit more sense. There's nothing wrong with smart homes and smart cities, if that's your pleasure. But if you can put low-cost devices into a facility to help automate measurements and or actuation of specific activities, that make that facility more effective and efficient, and maybe identify potential problems more readily, right? Rather than having a production line go down because something failed that could have been monitored through a simple device with a wireless connection or a wired connection, if you like, that allows you to get sensor data when you need it. So IoT, I think, has some really good applications or like stress tests for a bridge. You put some sensors on a bridge to indicate levels of stress and tension over time, and you can have those backhaul to some server to monitor, you know, health and safety of infrastructure like that. So there's applications where I think this makes a lot of sense. But just by the sheer numbers, I mean, IoT is kind of a big deal. I think there's an estimated, I want to say 10, 15 billion IoT devices today. And that figure is supposed to double by 2030 or something like that. And of those, I think the vast majority, something like 80%, are supposed to be wirelessly connected. So there's a crap ton of stuff out there. My biggest concern about IoT, as you might expect, is the security aspect. They all speak certain protocols, and most of them are wireless-based. And some of them touch things that relate to critical infrastructure. And unfortunately, the IoT space has historically not had the greatest success in terms of implementing good security, probably for some very good reasons, like often they're not the most expensive or the most capable of devices. And so there's limitations in terms of what they can do. But, you know, just given that history, it's an area of concern where, especially where it touches things like critical infrastructure, things like public resources like water, oil, gas, power, things like that, that I get a little concerned, and I want to make sure that we have sufficient monitoring, that people are implementing good security practices like changing default credentials, you know, closing ports that aren't necessary. There's just a lot of dangerous stuff out there that I think is cause for concern that we probably need to be paying attention to.
Well, okay. Well, as we now wrap up our show, what do you think is going to happen in terms of cyber threat landscape? I guess, you know, we're coming close to the end of the year now and going into next year. What do you think like the biggest threat is going to be, the biggest cyber attack, if potential one, or what are your thoughts on that?
That's a tough question. I'm not sure that I can answer that question without sounding, you know, just becoming really stupid. I feel like every time I try to make a prophecy, I'm just shown to be a complete idiot. And I think the one thing that cyber has taught me, and although I'm fairly new to the field, maybe that's why I don't feel competent to answer that question, but although I'm fairly new, what I've seen is that cyber has the potential to surprise us all at any moment. Something like software supply attacks, supply chain attacks, software supply chain attacks. I don't think we even knew that was a thing before, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And now there's a whole portion of the security industry that kind of focuses on that. So I think there's going to be something that will surprise us. I think the most important thing to focus on is shoring up our own security posture so that whatever does come, we're somewhat prepared to deal with it. And I think, you know, that it's going to be surprising, I think, because we've broadened the scope and the access to tools to so many people. And I'm mostly focused on wireless, so I can just talk about that. There's this trend of what I call the democratization of wireless hacking through an incredible availability of hardware and software tools that enable inexperienced people to engage in bad behavior. And that trend continues, and I think we're just going to continue to see interesting things occur as a result of that, and then some subset of those people tweak things in a way that no one would have expected, and now we have this whole new attack vector that no one thought about. And I think that's probably the best I can do to answer that question. Hopefully that's helpful.
Oh, that's great. Sounds great. Well, finally, Brett, what's the best way to someone to reach out to you in case they want to know more about Bastille, your services, or they just want to ask you questions? What's the best way for prospect or one of these or one of our or a member of our audience, what's the best way to reach out, have them reach out to you?
Yeah, so step one would be I would just have them go to our website. You can get there by typing bastille.net. That's BASTILLE.net. And then, you know, I would probably the simplest thing is just go into the corner of the website and click contact and fill out the form and someone will connect with you. There's some connections, email addresses and phone numbers that you can reach out to as well. And, you know, depending on your need, if you want to just learn more about it, feel free. We also put out regular webinars and other similar type marketing material that might be of interest. We just did a webinar recently on some of the more recent wireless vulnerabilities that have been published both in the media as well as in conferences like Black Hat and DEF CON. So that I think is probably hitting the website pretty soon. So you can explore that and just kind of see some material and see what we're all about or reach out to us through the contact form.
Well, that sounds excellent. Brett, we thank you for your time this evening and we hope to have you on future podcasts.
Thanks, Robbie. Appreciate you having me on board.
Take care. Have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye.